Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, December 16, 2013. Ed Snowden is an American patriot.
I'm a flag-waving patriotic nephew of my Uncle Sam, a rough-riding, fighting Yankee man.
And will the U.S. give him amnesty?
Mom and apple pie and the freedoms that we all enjoy across this beautiful land. I worked hard and I'd fight hard for the old red, white, and blue. And I'll die a whole lot harder if it comes to where I have to. I'm a flag-waving patriotic nephew of my Uncle Sam, a rough-riding, fighting Yankee man.
Ed Snowden's hunkered down in Moscow, where he has 1 year of asylum, and then who knows what will happen. And it's fascinating because over the weekend, the NSA floated the idea of granting Snowden amnesty if he will return all of the files that he took. Now, that's a pretty tall order at this point, but let's take this one item at a time. First of all, the New York Times published a story on Saturday, the least read edition of the newspaper each week. And in it, they buried this hint that the NSA, through one of its attorneys, a guy named Rick Ledgett, is floating the idea of amnesty for Snowden. That was not the headline of their story. Their story was something that we have reported on a few weeks back, and that is that the NSA doesn't know exactly what Snowden looked at, what he copied, what he took. Now, the Times gives a different set of reasons for why the NSA doesn't know. Our insiders, former NSA operatives Bill Binney and Russell Tice, said that they intentionally didn't put tracking software into their own systems so that there wouldn't be a paper trail for accountability in the future. The Times spins it in a different direction, saying that Snowden picked the outpost working for the contractor Booz Allen Hamilton in Hawaii because they had not yet added control software that other systems received after the WikiLeaks cache that we now attribute to Chelsea Manning. Now, this is a very interesting, different set of explanations, but the headline in the Times on Saturday reads, "Officials say U.S. may never know extent of Snowden's leaks." And buried deep in that story is the mention that Rick Ledgett says that there is a discussion underway at the NSA about offering him an amnesty deal. Then, I didn't see the show, but apparently 60 Minutes broadcast an interview that included Ledgett last night, Sunday, which includes a discussion of this amnesty proposal. No mention of it in Monday's New York Times website. Nothing in my San Francisco Chronicle or the little local paper that I read here, the Marin Independent Journal. But The Guardian, based in Britain, made this a top story on its website today. NSA officials consider Snowden amnesty in return for documents. Now, one thing he could tell them in an amnesty deal is what he took. But we're told that he offloaded everything in Hong Kong and didn't even travel to Moscow with any of the files that he had copied. And so it's not really clear whether Snowden could get Glenn Greenwald, Laura Poitras, the folks at the Washington Post. Some of the articles, some of the files are with the New York Times now, some with Der Spiegel. And so I'm really pleased to see this floated. And we don't know where it will lead. But it's very interesting to see that the NSA needs Ed Snowden's information, and they're willing to do some pretty interesting things to try to get it back. And in a report just breaking here midday on Monday, a federal judge, Richard Leon, appointed by George W. Bush to the bench, has ruled that the NSA's phone record collection, the metadata collection program, is likely unconstitutional. This is a very important development. It's based on a suit brought by plaintiffs Larry Klayman and Charles Strange. I don't know the basis of the claim, and I only have a brief story here that Richard Leon issued his ruling. He immediately put it on hold so that it can be appealed and will not take effect immediately. But the judge said that the mass collection of phone metadata was indiscriminatory, arbitrary, quote, the almost Orwellian technology that enables the government to store and analyze the phone metadata of every telephone user in the United States is unlike anything that could have been conceived of in 1970. And that's a quote from a 68-page ruling. We will certainly follow up on this, and I'm pleased to see some progress, a little bit of traction, in constitutional challenges to what is clearly unconstitutional surveillance that's being conducted on a massive scale. And I want to note that there is a controversy raging, partly stoked by my friend Sibel Edmonds at her website, BoilingFrogsPost.com, and she is sharply critical of Glenn Greenwald, considers him to be a profiteer, and is very dubious about his new arrangement with the publishing entity that hasn't surfaced yet, which is being funded by PayPal and eBay billionaire Pierre Omidyar. And I have my own questions about Omidyar, but I really don't share the view that Sibel has taken on this, and I will air it out in an upcoming Boiling Frogs Round Table. That's the new video series we've started. We haven't scheduled a recording date, but we do hope to have it out before the end of this year. I'm grateful to the people who subscribe and support my work and help pay the bills over here at peterbcollins.com, like Nick Yaksich, Sally Soriano, Brian Mazey, Gary Washington. They are monthly subscribers, and I'd like you to join their ranks. And at the end of the year, a lot of people make decisions about their giving. Any support for the Peter B. Collins Show is not tax deductible, okay? I'm not a nonprofit. But I welcome your financial support. It's what makes this viable. And it's squeaky over here, I have to tell you. I'm not making money doing this podcast. I do cover my expenses and, you know, pay the rent here a little bit, that sort of thing. But nothing that it qualifies as taxable income. So I would encourage you, if you've been thinking about it, to step up. Go to peterbcollins.com. Right under my picture on the homepage is the link to sign up. Our subscriptions are $5 a month. You can cancel any time. Or the best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get our bonus book of the moment, which is Spying on Democracy by Heidi Boghossian. And the other way you can support our efforts here is by following the links at peterbcollins.com over to audible.com. They have over 150,000 audiobooks that you can download to your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And here's the deal. If you sign up for a 30-day free trial at Audible, they will give you your first audiobook download completely free, any one of their titles. And for your free trial subscription, which you can cancel anytime, and if you cancel within 30 days, it doesn't cost you a penny, Audible will pay me $15 for your trial membership. So it's a sweetheart win-win proposition. It's a no-risk, no-cost way that you can kick in 15 bucks to support this podcast. And I hope you'll not only do it yourself, but maybe give some gift subscriptions to friends for Christmas or spread the word in your progressive communities that this is a great way to support our program. Well, they've done it again. The FBI has framed another schlub in a case of alleged domestic terrorism. And the plot is so consistent. A paid FBI informant was his handler. Terry Lee Lowen, aged 58, of Wichita, Kansas, was arrested as he was transporting what he thought were explosives toward the airport in Wichita, planning to detonate them. He was under the watch of two undercover FBI agents who started communicating with him on the internet earlier this year. They report that he told them he'd been studying Islam and Sharia law, and he wanted to engage in jihad on behalf of Al-Qaeda. So they helped him buy some materials that he thought would explode when he set off the bomb. Apparently he was planning to take himself out at the same time, if you believe what the FBI tells us, and I for one don't. It's just another case of political theater and an abuse of the civil rights and constitutional rights of Americans. And speaking of that, this Wednesday marks 8 weeks of illegal detention of my friend and colleague Roger Shuler in Shelby County, Alabama. And I'm sorry to say there's no progress on his case. And it's fair to say that Roger is really determined. He is uncompromising in his belief that his constitutional rights have been violated. I think he's kind of waiting for a miracle. But that is his call to make, and he remains behind bars there. I want to tip you off, and I'll link to these in the show file at peterbcollins.com. There is some interesting commentary from right-wingers who really detest Roger Shuler, but who agree that this is a travesty of justice. Starting with the guy who blogs at popehat.com, his name is Ken White. He's certainly a very bright legal mind. And he notes that there are a lot of political or legal vagaries with the way this case is being conducted. So the permanent injunction, which has been issued by the retired court judge Nielsen, who's presiding over this kangaroo court case, says that it prohibits any defamatory statement about the petitioners, Riley and his alleged paramour. And this is the sort of vague language that courts have used as a basis to strike down prior restraints on speech. The permanent injunction doesn't include any substantive discussion of the prior restraint issue. The judge, by approving what appears to be a proposed order submitted by the plaintiff, dismisses the concept of prior restraint with scare quotes in the first footnote, and implying it's a silly argument. And Ken White says it isn't. Though the order cites authority for the correct proposition that defamation is not protected by the First Amendment, it includes no analysis whatsoever of the wall of authority on the subject of prior restraint of allegedly defamatory speech. I find that shocking from a judicial officer. And the proposed order justifies the injunction by saying that Riley and Duke are in professions that can be harmed by defamation. But the order doesn't try to establish what is exceptional about their claim. And it repeats the frankly ridiculous argument that they are put in physical danger by defamation associating them with abortion. So this is coming from somebody who dismisses Roger Shuler as a crank and a vexatious litigant. That's one of the terms he's used. Now, what is also interesting is that someone who was in the past a target of Roger Shuler's reporting in Alabama, a guy named Sloan Beshinsky, he runs a blog called Good Morning Birmingham. I'll link to his page as well, because it's interesting. Beshinsky is a lawyer who used to practice in Birmingham. His brother Major Beshinsky was the subject of stories by Roger Shuler after Major apparently committed suicide, or in the case of Shuler's reporting, Shuler challenged the notion that it was a suicide on a golf course. And I won't relitigate the Major Beshinsky death, but Sloan, who again is no fan of Roger Shuler's, based on his contact with him in the past, says that he really thinks there's something wrong here. And it's interesting because his blog post is written in the form of a letter to a friend named Morticia. And the two of them repeatedly refer to the Riley clan with a capital R, capital C, and talk about them as a political machine in Alabama. And Beshinsky writes, "I'm not persuaded the judge can force Shuler to take down adjudicated false and libelous allegations from his blog. I think the First Amendment allows you to say just about anything you want to say about someone else. I think the remedy is at law, a lawsuit for damages. And for that reason, I question the judge sealing the court record." He has since unsealed it. But it's very interesting to hear these two people who are no friends of Roger Shuler, who believe firmly that he is the victim of injustice in Alabama. I hope to see him victorious, and I'd like to see Roger Shuler walk free of that jail sometime very soon. Well, over the weekend, we learned that two citizens of Saudi Arabia have been released from the gulag at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. They are 35-year-old Saad Qahtani and 48-year-old Hamoud Abdullah Hamoud. Neither man was ever charged with a crime. Records show they were both suspected of being members of Al-Qaeda, but nothing was ever proven, and since they were never charged, our government has finally released them. There are 9 Saudis left and a total of 160 prisoners still being held at Guantanamo Bay. The Oversight Committee that used to be run by Henry Waxman when the Democrats ran the House is in the hands of Daryl Issa, the sleazy car alarm millionaire, or maybe he's a billionaire from California. And there are 2 issues before the Oversight Committee that could get very interesting. One relates to the EPA, where a guy named John Beale has just pled guilty and will be sentenced in federal court later this week. He defrauded the government of about $1 million in salary and benefits by basically telling his bosses at the Environmental Protection Agency that he was secretly a CIA agent, and he would disappear for long periods of time and continue to draw his paycheck. So the new head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, is being targeted by Republicans for her alleged failure to deal with this problem. Now, she apparently knew about it a year ago. She has moved to fire him and investigate him since she became the director of the EPA. So I'm not sure exactly what the Republicans will find here, but I think it's important to note that she is the target of this investigation, and it's based on the fraudulent behavior of EPA employee John Beale. I think that one is going to make some noise, probably. Also, before the House Oversight Committee today, there's a hearing on the Obamacare navigators. And I was alerted to this by the sleazy right-wing, what's the right way to call him? He's a propagandist, James O'Keefe. He was the protege of Andrew Breitbart, who did the selectively edited videos that made him look like showing up in Acorn offices as a pimp with his girlfriend who was posing as a prostitute. And they created phony crimes and entrapped Acorn employees in a way that led to the demise of the organization. Well, now they're going to show some videos of these Obamacare navigators. And in different states, the contracts were given to different groups. The one that I guarantee you will not show up in James O'Keefe's phony edited videos is about the navigators in California, because they work for an offshoot of a political action committee called the Western Growers PAC. The Western Growers are on record as outspoken opponents of Obamacare, but it didn't stop them from applying for the contract to manage the navigators to help people sign up for Obamacare in California. Isn't that beautiful? And so James O'Keefe may come up with some interesting situations that he has contrived, or maybe even some bad behavior by appointees of the Obama administration in states around the country. It's a huge program. There's certainly a lot of room for inappropriate behavior right up to and including fraud. But you can't expect James O'Keefe to be fair or impartial about ferreting that out. Great news, the association called the American Studies Association, which represents American professors and has about 5,000 members, has voted to endorse an academic boycott of Israeli colleges and universities. This is an extension of the BDS movement, boycott, divestiture, sanctions against Israel for their brutal treatment of the Palestinians. And in a podcast that we expect to release tomorrow or later this week, we're going to bring you a blockbuster interview with author Max Blumenthal. His powerful new book, Goliath, really pulls back the curtain on the systemic racism in the Israeli government and how is it applied to minorities, including Palestinians. And it's very powerful stuff. In that same in-depth interview package, we're going to bring you a conversation with Professor David Lloyd. He teaches at the University of California, Riverside, has been one of the professors leading this charge, and we'll get a lot more information on what the potential impacts are on Israel, which, of course, is fighting these issues very, very hard. And finally today, you may know that on Friday, there was another gunman loose on a high school campus in suburbs of Denver, Colorado. And in this case, he took his own life. A student named Carl Pearson, who took his guns to school, and he apparently was going to try to kill a librarian who had offended him, but instead he shot a fellow student named Claire Davis, who is still in serious condition. He died at the scene. Now, I don't report on all of these shootings around the country because there are so many of them, and the corporate media goes, you know, deep, long, and hard on these stories and, you know, plays up the violence and the loss of life. But this occurred just about a year after the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut at the Sandy Hook Elementary School. And almost nothing has happened. There have been some state-level gun laws that have been amended or passed in the last year. And even those modest steps are being thwarted by law enforcement officials in Colorado and elsewhere. The New York Times Monday reporting that the sheriff of Weld County, John Cook, goes around and says that he won't enforce the law on 30-round magazine clips because he personally doesn't think it's constitutional. And in New York State, where Governor Cuomo has signed one of the toughest gun law packages in the nation, two sheriffs have said publicly they won't enforce the laws. And frankly, it is amazing to see the gun culture in this country simply unaffected, oblivious to the significant loss of life and the risk that people face on a daily basis from gun violence. And yet, these hardliners don't care about the mounting statistics of the people killed and maimed and wounded. No, because their right to kill somebody is more important to them than safe communities. And it's really sad that in a year where I give credit to Mayor Bloomberg, who I don't support on many issues, but he's funded the mayor's committee against gun violence. President Obama, he burned a lot of political capital in the first part of this year, trying to get just simple background checks required of all gun registrants. He was double-crossed by Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and the NRA on a very modest federal plan. And so this country is in the control of people with their fingers on triggers. And all I can say is it's really sad, and we've got to find a way to confront these heavily armed and not so heavily informed people and see if we can make some changes. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast you are authorized to share with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.